Ilya Kazan, one of the foremost directors of Hollywood films and Broadway theater, died yesterday in Manhattan at the age of 94. Many critics consider Kazan to be the most influential director of American actors in the 20th century. He discovered and cast Marlon Brando, James Dean, and Warren Beatty in such films as Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront, East of Eden, and Splendor in the Grass. His films also include Baby Doll, A Face in the Crowd, and The Last Tycoon. Kazan's career in theater was equally influential. In the 1930s, he worked with the group theater, where he followed the vision of Lee Strasberg and learned the style of acting that became known as the method. He later co-founded the Actors Studio with Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends and colleagues never forgave him for naming names when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee during its relentless search for communists and communist sympathizers. In later years, Kazan published several novels, also his autobiography, in which he defended his actions during the Red Scare. Terry spoke with Ilya Kazan in 1988, after the publication of his memoir, A Life. Before we hear their conversation, let's revisit a signature Brando moment.
I shall!
You put that howling down there and go to bed!
Yes, I want my girls out here!
You shut up! You're going to get the law,
hey,
you...
Stella!
You can't see that woman and then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, you're...
I'll say haul you in and turn a fire
loose
on you.
Girls, I want my girls down here.
You stinker.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Ilya Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to talk with you specifically about some of the movies you've directed and some of the scenes within those films. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played it like a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous and he was marvelous in it, and that was his audition. He didn't know it, but then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who really would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So, but anyway, Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
When I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, what went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Once in a decade, a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough, and he would have been good, and he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on, but he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. Anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contracting, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliate him. The part Lee Carr played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid, and I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while, and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history, And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it for you, dude.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
Skunk, we got you for the manager. He brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You know, it's great. It's your classic talking head scene. It's two guys in a cab. In the rear view window, there's actually Venetian blinds, so you can't even see the traffic coming through.
There isn't any.
Yeah, so it's just two guys talking.
If we had traffic, Terry, it would have been a distraction, wouldn't it? Don't you think so?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because you're just totally focused on their faces and on what they're saying.
Right.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride. And nobody threatened me much. Once a fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation.
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them, the same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation, too. I feel brotherly towards them.
I want to play a scene from this movie, and this is a scene where, well, for our listeners who haven't seen the movie in a long time, in East of Eden, there's a father played by Raymond Massey, and he has two sons. One son he favors, the son he doesn't favor is James Dean. And James Dean has worked really hard to endear himself to his father. He's invested money in bean futures in the hopes of making back money that his father lost. And it's his father's birthday. He's presenting him the money, but his father won't accept it. Here's that scene with Raymond Massey and James Dean.
That's for you. And it's all the money you lost in the lettuce business. And that's for you, and I made it for you.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad. I want you to have it.
You'll have to give it back.
Who? I can't give it.
To the people you got it from.
British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody. We paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over the market for that stuff.
Cal, I sign my name, and boys go out, and some die, and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that? I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but...
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up, and we'll just keep it in here.
I'll never take it.
There's a great part right after that where you can't tell whether James Dean is going to hug or slug his father.
That is good, yeah.
Now, you write in your book that there really was a tension between James Dean and Raymond Massey. And
yes,
you basically tried to exploit that in the movie.
They didn't like each other. And especially Ray Massey couldn't stand Dean. He just hated to play scenes with him. And I didn't, I guess I did exploit it because I didn't do anything about curing it or easing it. And you see how much he resents him in the scene, in the role, but also he did in life. And it served my purposes to not do anything about it. I didn't egg them on to each other, but I didn't do anything to keel it.
If James Dean had more technique as an actor, if he had been more experienced, would it have been unnecessary to play up that antagonism in real life between Dean and Massey?
It wouldn't have hurt, Terry. The truth is it wouldn't have hurt. Everybody's so chummy on a stage set, you know. Everybody gets coffee and gets flattered and everything else, and very soon they lose the sense of what they... a very driving emotion underneath the scene. They become comfortable. Comfortable is not good when an actor gets too and stays away from everybody and stays, you know, just is flattered and has his girlfriend there too. God knows what goes on. You know, it's better to irritate them a little bit so they're on edge. I mean, it's very serious business, emotional film.
Yeah. You know, in the clips that we just heard, we heard from Brando and from Dean, two very different actors in that Brando you describe as an actor with a lot of technique, Dean as an actor who had virtually none, at least at the time you directed him. How does that change you as a director, depending on whether you're working with someone who has a lot of technique or someone who's more of a natural and doesn't have that technique?
You adapt to what each one is. I talked more to Jimmy than I ever did to Marlon. I took him aside and... finally, when I felt he was disturbed in life by what was happening in his own personal life, I moved him into a dressing room on the Warner Brother lot, and I took the dressing room directly facing it so that I'd always be at hand. I was like a father to him or a big brother to him, and looked after him. Every morning I'd call him out and see what condition he was in, whether he had a miserable night or not. And then I had to several times stop him from owning a horse or a motorbike or whatever, you know. So it became a very different, more intense, more particular relationship. With Marlon, I didn't have to do anything like that.
Let's talk more about acting and your style of directing. Now, you were a member of the group theater in the mid-30s and a co-founder of the Actor Studio. These are the two places where what's been called the Method was born. How would you describe the Method, and do you think of yourself as subscribing to it?
The method has to do with retreat from artificial emotionalism, where emotion is conveyed by signs and gestures and voice patterns and so forth, but where it's where on the other hand it's actually felt by the actor. He actually feels it. The emotion that he's portraying, it's there in him. And there are techniques which are obvious. They're not so complicated and not so mysterious for arousing emotion by remembering certain things in yourself so that the scene becomes, in a sense, a part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as directing with the method, with that method?
I think I do, yes. I think I try to get the real thing out of actors, and I try to stop them from in what we call indicating or gesturing, suggesting a scene by the way they are. In England, they do it. They do it differently. The voice is very important there, and the way they, they have different kinds of plays there. And I don't think that I'm any good to direct Shakespeare or George Bernard Shaw or any play that depends on the way lines are read. I think I'm only good when the play relates to my own experience.
And to the experience of the actor who's playing it.
That's correct. Right, Terry.
Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings
in
the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it, and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And, for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors are really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. I thought, you know, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really, except my family and my work. Those are the two things I have, and I thought, why should I give up my my career for something I don't believe in? I don't believe in it. And if people who are communists are still are going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it, I also feel that then the hell with them. I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who have never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry, I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both ways would have been difficult for me.
Ilya Kazan is my guest. I want to get to something you say at the very, very end of your book. You say that when you die, you don't want a big memorial shindig with lots of speeches. You want a big party, but no speeches, and you want everyone that you've ever known invited, including even your enemies, if they're still alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you want that?
Well, because I'm an old-fashioned family-type Mediterranean man. I do like my family enormously. I have a great big family. I have five grandchildren, one more on the way. I have five children. I have stepchildren. I have all kinds of friends that I've had through the years. Not alienated, the opposite. They've become closer and closer. And I just want to say to them, thank you very much for what you've given me in the way of experience and happiness. And here, have a party. And there are all my sweaters and books and things. Help yourself.
Okay. I bet you wish you could be around to watch this party when it happens.
I would, yes. I would. I hope there's good liquor there, that's all. I hope nobody gets a hangover.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You've been very nice.
Ilya Kazan in 1988. He died yesterday at the age of 94. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Barbara Bogave.